Hello and welcome to the One Stop English podcast for March 2017. Each month we bring together teachers, editors and experts to discuss what's going on in the world of ELT. I'm your host, Sam Wadsworth, former teacher and current editor here at Macmillan. Joining me this month are Patrick Curry, Delta qualified teacher and editor on One Stop English.
Hi Sam.
Becca Sanderson, former teacher and editor of numerous business and general English titles.
Hello there.
And Alex Tustain, AQE Manager at Avalon School of English, London.
Hi, Sam.
This month we'll be discussing whether teachers talk too much, how words are chosen for the Macmillan Dictionary, and learner autonomy. We also have an interview with Tom Kittle, Director at NILE, the Norwich Institute for Language Education, and MA Qualified Specialist in Language Testing. Okay, so Alex, for the benefit of our listeners, what on earth is an AQE manager?
Well, AQE stands for Avalon Quantum English, which is a teaching and learning system that focuses on students' speaking and listening skills. And it's used in our home school in London, Avalon School, as well as several schools abroad, and hopefully more to come.
Great, okay. All right, let's get started. Patrick, I understand you've got some good news for talkative teachers.
Well, yeah, I thought today we're going to talk about teacher talk time, which is something that gets drummed into teachers on their CELTA course, their initial qualification, in their Delta, in observations, professional development sessions by colleagues and students as well. And everyone hears that too much teacher talk time is basically a bad thing. So I thought what we'd do today is discuss that and see if we can find out if it's actually not a bad thing.
Okay.
So first off, I want to talk about what the functions are. What do you guys think are the main uses of teacher talk time?
Well, the traditional use would be to present grammar, I think, a lot of the time.
So sort of instruction?
Yeah.
Okay.
And model the grammar or model the target language?
Yeah, model the functional language, yeah.
Yep.
Presentation of vocabulary?
Yep.
That kind of thing. What about instructions for activities, right? You need to explain how to do something.
And concept check things?
Yep.
Yep, so lots of excellent uses of teacher talk time. You've got things like clarification as well. You've got engaging the learners, so maybe giving little anecdotes, that kind of thing. But why is it considered bad? Like, why should teachers try to talk less?
Well, I think the idea is that students talk as much as they can, right?
Yeah.
That's the plan. You don't want a teacher just talking the entire time.
Yeah.
I mean, it basically limits the opportunities for students to develop their speaking if the teacher's talking themselves, right?
Sure, that's the idea.
Okay, anything else?
It might get a bit boring listening to your teacher talking all the time.
True, yeah.
I suppose it depends very much on the teacher, but yeah, increases boredom, maybe decreases their motivation, perhaps. And it means if the teacher's presenting, then the students don't have chances to discover stuff for themselves. The teacher's always explaining.
Yes, they're just spoon-fed everything.
Very much so. So, but is there any positives, any good points about teacher talk time?
I think if the teacher is interacting with the students, i.e. asking them questions and the students are answering or vice versa, I think the teacher talk time has a function. Where the teacher's just talking essentially to themselves, then that teacher talk time is wasted. It's not going anywhere.
Yeah, so if it's facilitating the class,
sure,
then it's useful.
Yeah, I think personalising language in an immediate context is kind of useful because a lot of times when you do a listening, that listening presents a particular grammar point and it's not that natural. If it's just focusing on present perfect, for example, that's all the students hear. But when the teacher talks, it's usually going to incorporate more grammar points. So it's more of a kind of natural context for the language. But what about if you have a teacher who talks too much? How can that teacher reduce their teacher talk time? What are kind of the techniques to get your teacher talk time down?
Alex, as teacher trainer, what do you think?
Well, the one thing that we focus on when we train teachers at Avalon is to embrace silence. There's nothing wrong with silence. I think the biggest danger is when teachers fill time with noise because it feels like a yawning gap of nothingness and they waffle on. That, in terms of training, that's just an observation thing that you can work on and develop over a period of time. Some people, like me, waffle on a lot in normal life. So taking that into the classroom is something that, with the help of an observer, that you can deal with.
It's probably a lot to do with confidence in your explanation as well, isn't it? Because I think a lot of teachers, certainly when they're starting out, would explain something probably quite clearly the first time, but then explain it again in a different way and explain it again in a different way because they think students aren't getting
the understanding. Yeah, if there's no direct response, then you might just start digging your hole and trying another way. But yeah, there's a lot to be said for just, like you said, Alex, silence and thinking time.
Yeah, silence gives the students time to kind of understand what's been said and work out things for themselves rather than just being talked at and having more information to take in. Obviously, the classic kind of eliciting rather than telling, so giving students the opportunity to work things out, using gesture as well, silent way. What about going the other way? If you wanted to use more teacher talk time, maybe, how could that benefit students? Is there a way that increased teacher talk time could give students any benefits?
There was this part of my CELTA course, and it was about telling a story to illustrate a grammar point or some language. And that was really interesting. That was like a focused listening. And I think that worked really well.
And actually, have you guys heard of Jamie Keddie? That's a big part of his method, is this storytelling method where he gets the students to sort of interject and ask questions to tell the anecdote.
He's got this thing. It's isn't it say something, ask something principle. So he'll basically tell them something, and then they can either ask him a question or he'll ask them a question based upon what he's told them. So if he started a story, for example, about something, an event that took place in the Arctic, and he talked about two animals that live in the Arctic, and he'd say, can any students think of animals that live in the Arctic? So then they'd have to interject, or they might ask questions as well. So
and you just get swept up by the story and forget that you're in a classroom and produce more language.
And so much emergent language, emergent grammar points and things that it's got to be a good method.
Absolutely. But preparation is the key for this as well, because obviously you have to know what you're going to say when you go into the classroom. If you don't prepare enough, then it could turn into, like Alex says, a lot of waffle, really, and students. It's a bit kind of unfocused for them. I saw an article in ELF magazine, which had another way to approach it, which talked about teacher talk time as teacher talk acts. So when you're preparing your class, you look at the moments in the class that you as a teacher are going to speak, and you work out what exactly is the purpose of that speech.
So, okay, can you give us some examples?
Well, say, for example, if you said at the start of the class, you're going to say, hi, everyone, how are you? That would come under the kind of category of greetings. And then you could use various instructions like, okay, everyone get into pairs, find three things you have in common with your partner. And you'd say, how necessary is that speech? And, and so what are the class gaining from me speaking at this point in the class? And there's other things like we talked about, instructing, eliciting, concept checking. And as you plan your class and you look at when you're speaking throughout the class, you decide which things are necessary and which things are not necessary. So I guess what the main thing to remember is when you're teaching a class and when you're planning the class and when you're going to speak is that your instructions or your speech should be as efficient or as instructive as possible.
Yeah, everything has a function.
Absolutely, So, that's pretty much what we're looking at with teacher talk time.
All right, thanks, Patrick. Becca, you're going to tell us how mic drop, share washing and hygge have made it into the Macmillan Dictionary.
Yes, well, of course, other dictionaries are available, but I thought, seeing as Macmillan Dictionary is a learner dictionary and aimed at students, teachers and teacher trainers and anyone ELT related, it would be a bit more relevant to our listeners. And it meant that I could contact Editor-in-Chief of Macmillan Dictionary, Michael Rundle, who I'd heard being interviewed by Stephen Fry on Radio 4, and he sounded very interesting. So yes, I thought I could bend his ear on the subject. So first, I asked him if he had any favourite words or phrases from the new releases, and he mentioned three in particular, which relate to the way news is being reported. Would anyone like to hazard a guess at what they are?
Fake news.
Yep, that's
fake
one.
News, post-truth, surely.
Yeah, post-truth is in there. And one more along the fake news line.
Alternative facts.
Correct.
Good,
very
nice.
good. Yeah, another word he liked was gaslighting. Have you heard of that one?
No,
I hadn't heard about that. That is when someone is manipulating and confusing someone to the point that that person starts to question what they know to be true, so to gaslight someone. Yeah, so the criteria, that's what I thought we could look at, the selection process for these new words. Of course, usage is the main thing, and that word has to show up frequently in corpus resources, and those resources take in a wide range of text types. So by looking at those corpora, they can see how a word is commonly used and get a better sense of where it sits in the lexicon. Things that they avoid, parochial words or phrases, not just one pocket of society using these words. Nothing too ephemeral or transitory. So it's got to be a long-lasting word. So, for example, what's the word which describes when you take a picture of your face?
Selfie.
Yeah, I didn't want to say yourself. Yeah. So that could have just been a blink and you'll miss it word. But in fact, Michael said that it was submitted to the Macmillan Open Dictionary, which is crowdsourced, 5 years ago. And so they just sort of sat on that word for a while and saw what happened to that word until it was deemed to be a keeper. And then it was upgraded to full status as a full entry in the Macmillan Dictionary. So some of these words are kind of slow burners. I also asked Michael if there was a word or phrase which didn't make the cut this time, but he wished had. And he said, we do also get submissions that don't quite work. Sometimes people just make words up, and we can't accept invented words when there's no evidence that anyone ever uses them. And sometimes they are real words with made-up definitions. Just last week, one of our readers in the US sent a detailed and very well-crafted definition of the noun Trump, with 7 different meanings. But unfortunately, we couldn't publish this without compromising the dictionary's political neutrality. So it's very diplomatic there, right, yeah. Michael. But I thought it'd be good to bring this back to the classroom and to think how much of an effort should teachers make to introduce these new words to the classroom. So, Alex?
I don't think the teacher should be introducing them, but if it's coming out from what the students want to express, especially, you know, their awareness of current affairs, then I would certainly have...
Okay, that's interesting. So you'd expect students to come in and say, well, what does this mean? What does post-truth mean? I keep seeing it.
That, or you can see that they're trying to express something that is going on around us, and therefore you might feed them some of the language that they're looking for.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, I've often talked in previous podcasts about encouraging students to use authentic materials, so newspapers, for example, and they might come across these words in newspaper reports.
It's
of course, you should definitely exploit the language there, for sure.
Yeah. Just one final thing, another little test for you guys. What do you think a smombie. Yeah.
So that's got to come from zombie. Hasn't
oh,
well,
yeah. Yeah. Is it something to do with? It's got to be sort of text messaging. Mm. Something to do with that, I think. I've heard this
somebody,
before.
Yeah, maybe you're in your phone. You know, you can't get away from your phone. Get
your head
away
down.
From
your walking.
Yeah. The S bit is social media zombie. A smombie.
Good.
And how about a dead walker?
Is that from The Walking Dead?
Game of Thrones, I was going to say. But yeah.
Is it like distracted walking? So they're kind of interconnected, these words, and they're not entries yet, but Michael and his team are keeping an eye on their usage. He says what's likely to happen is that one of these words will eventually kind of win out and the other one will die out, but they know there will be a word for this,
smombie.
This thing.
Yeah, smombie.
My vote's smombie.
I hate smombies as well.
Yeah. I kind of like dead walkers. I don't like them, but I like the word dead walker.
Okay.
But
right.
Yeah, they just have to ride it out and see which one is going to fit, is going to be used. So it's sort of a waiting game, isn't it? They've got to be quite patient.
Which one do you like, Becca?
Out of those two, I think I like a dead walker best.
We're dead right, don't we? We should put some money down on this, see what comes out on top.
But if anyone out there wants to submit a word for consideration, they can. Just send it to the Open Dictionary and it will be considered as a potential new entry. I have a word that I think could
go in. A suggestion?
A suggestion. A sploosh.
A sploosh?
Yeah, it's smaller than a splash. An extension of that is a splooshette. Which I think is quite useful for if someone's making you a cup of tea. And for me, I just want a tiny, tiny bit of milk.
A sploosh of milk.
A splooshette.
A splooshette of milk.
I think I'm
more of a splash man. I like a lot of milk.
But yes, they update 4 times a year. So, send in your entries. Get on the case.
Brilliant.
Vote sploosh.
So, listeners, what are your thoughts? Is teacher talk time always counterproductive or can it be used to good effect? Do you make an effort to teach up-to-date vocab? Email your comments to onestoppodcast@springernature.com. Okay, next up we've got Warmer of the Month. Each month we challenge our guest teacher to explain a fun communicative activity in no more than 5 steps. So Alex, over to you.
I'm not sure if it's fun. Or communicative, but...
good start.
We have a very basic activity that we do with any new student who enters our classes. And that's to get them to write their names up on the board with the aid of the teacher and the other students in the room using phonemes. So we have a phoneme chart up on the classroom wall. And obviously no student enters into the classroom knowing the phonemes, or certainly there's no expectation that they do. But we like to do that as a warm-up activity together. It kind of breaks the ice with both them, the teacher, and the other students. Mm. It's a kind of communicative activity from that perspective, because we're going to look up at that phoneme chart and we're going to practice saying their names, you know, jowl or whatever it is. That's always a difficult one. And just kind of enter into a bit of a, not so much a dialogue, but kind of a to-ing and fro-ing over how your name sounds. as opposed to how it's written.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess, you know, at your school, the speaking school, that's such a big part of it, their understanding of phonemes and how to use them.
Well, it's immediately trying to break that sense of how language, you know, even our lowest level students don't really have a problem with reading language. You know, they can see it, they can passively understand it on a page, where they all students struggle is hearing it. And so as a very basic activity to kind of immediately contextualize, right, we're going to look at how things sound as opposed to how they look. We find that quite useful, and as I kind of alluded to, there are other kind of breaking the ice payoffs in terms of getting them up and doing that up on the board together.
I think it's great as well because you involve the other students, so it's immediately a very kind of supportive environment. So not only is it the student with the teacher, but the other students hopefully are supportive and they want to help out if the student's struggling, and so you immediately feel like you're part of the class rather than just one new student.
Yeah, I mean, strangers. We have continuous enrollment, so you know that means that you could have a class that with established students already who've been through that process.
Okay, and they can pitch in and help.
They can pitch in, but it works just as well for a brand new class and no one's ever done it before. You could spend a lot of time on it.
And so here's a question, is it level dependent? Could you do it with a beginner class?
Yeah, completely.
Could you do it with an elementary class?
Yes, most definitely. I don't see, it doesn't really matter. I mean, everyone knows their own name.
Right.
And so we're just trying to establish how it sounds.
And do you, if you have a student with a very short name, do you ask them to do their surname as well?
You might do if you need to string it out.
Right, it would be easy for me, wouldn't it?
I mean, my name is unusual, you know, my surname in particular is unusual to the point that Sam can rarely pronounce it properly. But, you know, yeah, I'd obviously do my, the teacher would probably model it first with their own name, obviously. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that's not a problem.
Well, that's an excellent activity, yeah.
Great. Now it's time for Word of the Month. Each month we discuss a piece of ELT jargon and how it affects teachers. So Patrick, what can you tell us about learner autonomy?
Okay, learner autonomy. So this is the idea that learners have the ability to take charge of their own learning. And it means learners becoming more aware of the individual learning process and becoming responsible for setting their own targets and reviewing their own progress. I think the problem here is that teachers aren't always aware of the ways that their learners can become more responsible for their own learning. So I kind of looked at what learners need to do to become more autonomous, and usually divided from the reading I've done, it's usually divided into five steps, which is determining their objectives, defining their content, selecting methods and techniques, monitoring the process of acquisition and evaluating what has been acquired. Does that all make sense?
Okay, so can we just have a look at some of those and just see what we think they mean? So determining objectives, would that mean that they actually establish as a class what they want to learn, like whether they want to learn the present perfect or whether they want to learn functional language for a specific situation?
Yeah, I think this, it depends on the individual learner really, because I don't think it's about setting class objectives. It's about learners as individuals understanding what they need to learn, whether they're, if they need to learn kind of presentation language or if they've been struggling with past perfect or something. So identifying their own weaknesses and then defining those objectives, saying what they need themselves, which not just in the classroom, but possibly outside the classroom as well.
Okay. Defining content, what do we think that means?
I think defining content would look at where you find the language, whether it's going to be in authentic content, in a course book, if it could be a listening or reading, what works for that particular student.
Oh, I see. It's finding something that they're really going to engage with and perhaps encourage them to learn more and independently.
Identifying, the content which works well for them. So.
Okay. Selecting methods and techniques. Is that their own personal methods, students' methods for taking notes or for studying the classroom, or is that?
Yeah, I think it can be. It can be. So, I mean, methods and techniques, it depends a lot on if you're a good note taker, if you're better at kind of, having full sentences with examples or putting
learner training.
Right.
Yeah, a lot of learner training, So, I mean, it's not telling the teacher what to do, obviously. It's understanding as a student how you learn best.
Okay. Monitoring the procedure of acquisition.
I think we were considering this might be simply monitoring how students are taking notes.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously that depends on the learner type, but I think it's easy as a teacher to kind of do your thing and the student does their thing, but you don't follow it up and see what they're doing with that information in terms of note taking and following that up outside the class.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And evaluating what has been acquired.
So I think this is more of a review process. So once you've learned, knowing or being aware of the need to go back and look at it and make sure it's correct make
self-reflection.
Sure you, yeah, absolutely.
So like maybe a student diary, that kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah. So teachers are encouraged to do this a lot with their teaching practice. They reflect on what they've learned. And then this is encouraging learners to look at what they've learned as well. So yeah, this whole thing, learner autonomy, doesn't actually eradicate the need for teachers, and it doesn't encourage self-instruction. So students don't go home and just learn from the internet. That doesn't happen. Teachers obviously play a huge, hugely important role in learner autonomy, as learners are kind of dependent on teachers to create the environment where learner autonomy is possible.
Okay.
So yeah, in traditional educational models, the teacher will impart the knowledge and set the goals. But in, you know, students in this learner autonomy model, students will go away and find their own information and set their own goals. But the teacher will be the overseer.
Yeah, it has to be sort of engineered by the teacher.
Right, facilitator rather than imparter of knowledge.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. So do we agree that, I mean, learner autonomy, is it agreed that it's an important thing? Should we be encouraging it more?
Surely that's the whole point of our existence, you know. I always say to students who come to our school, it's probably not good on a commercial basis, that once you're finished here, I hope that you never need to pay for an English course again. We want you to leave your course here being able to continue learning. And I think I would say regarding learner autonomy that there's a big difference between now and, say, 20, 30 years ago, is students' access to English is much greater than it used to be. And that largely is access through stuff that they hear. Whether it be movies or, you know, just they've got people coming to their towns, their cities, they're hearing English a lot more than probably they could 20, 30 years ago. And I think from my perspective, learner autonomy is very much enabling students to listen better, because I feel if they can engage with English in a social setting, or they can better understand that movie that they're listening to, that piece of music, that TV show, they're much more motivated and much more inclined to carry on learning in whichever way that suits their learner type.
And so is a large part about is really sort of instilling that curiosity, giving them that impetus to sort of follow up on things that they don't understand, or look those things up, or try to do better in the future.
It becomes kind of second nature rather than only within the English classroom do I speak English.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I mean, I wanted to look at a couple more things. What can teachers do to foster a learner autonomy, that kind of environment? I think the most important thing would be talking to students about it and raising awareness so they kind of know that it exists. They know that they're not solely reliant on a teacher to deliver their learning or their knowledge, really. Anything else that you guys can think of?
Well, I think it's touched on the first thing you mentioned, determining objectives. I mean, what exactly do your students want to achieve? Mm. Is it, you know, they need particular style of English to pass a particular exam, or is it I just want to be able to engage and use this language in terms of spoken and listening skills? Mm-hmm. And I think once you've ascertained what they want to achieve, obviously you can encourage them to follow whatever path suits them.
Yeah, I think it can be divided broadly as well into inside and outside the classroom. Mm-hmm. So outside the classroom, you could say learner journals, something they can keep. So if they see something when they're out and about, making sure that they make a note of it and record it and look it up and whatever they do, whether it's pronunciation, translation, example sentence, that kind of thing. In class as well. I mean, earlier on we touched on teacher talk time, but there are things you can do in class as well, which obviously don't involve the teacher. Things like encouraging pair work, encouraging small group work, and then learners can work together if they're of a similar level to set their own goals or their pair goals, for example. And getting students to be more aware of that and encourage that. So then the teacher, as you said, becomes a facilitator and they can oversee the note taking and the error correction, but they're not necessarily setting all the target language.
Yeah, agreed. All right. Thanks very much, Patrick. Let's move on to this month's interview. This month, Patrick is talking to Tom Kittle about formative and summative testing, how to make exam classes fun, and whether we need country-specific tests of English.
Hi, Tom.
Good morning.
Morning. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Thank you for inviting me onto the podcast.
Thank you for taking the time to speak to us. First off, I wondered if you could tell us a little bit about yourself.
So my name's Tom Kittle. I'm director at NILE, which is the Norwich Institute for Language Education. We're a specialist teacher training, teacher development, ELT institute in the east of England. And I guess I got into English language teaching through the CELTA and travelling and teaching, and then did the DELTA and the Masters in Language Testing, which is why I'm talking to you today about testing and assessment. At NILE, I run our MA modules on testing and assessment, and also our module on language teaching methodology. on a personal side, I've got two young kids who keep me very busy outside of work and sometimes inside of work as well.
Brilliant. So testing and assessment's your specialism, and a lot of ELT teachers are drawn to a particular specialism, like teaching pronunciation or business English. What particularly fascinated you about testing and assessment?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right that many teachers do find their specialism within English language teaching. I've always thought of testing and assessment as the black sheep of the ELT world, because really, when we're in the classroom, we're out of the classroom, very little of our job isn't concerned with evaluation or assessment of some form. We're always assessing how well the lesson has gone, or seeing whether our students are making progress, or deciding whether to move on to the next topic or area. And yet, there's so little initial teacher training devoted to testing and assessment, and I think that means that teachers can be scared of it as a concept and also as a practice that they feel they're on top of. And so that kind of interested me. I was an examiner for international exams. I wrote an exam preparation book for a particular exam when I was working in Thailand. And then I got involved in a major national testing project and realized at that point how much I had to learn. And so I did an MA focused particularly on language testing to kind of give me the background knowledge and the theory to support my practice.
Brilliant. Yeah, as you say, a lot of teachers and students actually do find exam classes quite serious and even scary. There's a kind of fear factor about them. But with the classes themselves, can they and possibly should they be more fun, more for both teachers and students?
Yeah, I think absolutely so. One of the things I think we need to acknowledge is that tests make us anxious. That's unavoidable. The very word test and exam sends a shiver down the spine and a cold sweat in many people. There are those rare beasts who enjoy being tested, but I think for most teachers and students the concept of testing is quite a scary concept. But that doesn't mean that test preparation classes should be scary. The seriousness aspect of it can be very important, and that depends on the teacher and the students and the focus they want to give to that. But I think scary is unavoidable situation, because many of the most fun, most dynamic teaching activities that we do in the classroom are actually great for test preparation, particularly those that build the underlying skills, the enabling skills for the test itself. They help to reduce the test anxiety when it comes to that moment of the exam. So I think it is the teacher's responsibility to look beyond the test questions and actually get to the underlying skills that are being measured and try to think of interesting, exciting, interactive and fun ways to work with those with the students.
Absolutely. So you wrote a book about this, and can you think of one particular activity which stood out for you from that book which made exam preparation more fun?
One thing I'm really interested in myself is actually learner engagement and learner autonomy within testing and assessment. I think as teachers we can find out so much more about students from the questions they ask than the questions they answer. Mm-hmm. So for example, inviting students to bring in their own reading text and create questions for their colleagues in the classroom can give the teacher so much insight into what they see as what should be tested, what is being tested, the way that questions work. And that gives the students the power to choose a text that's meaningful for them and to focus in on areas that they've found relevant within the text. I think these kind of throwing the test creation, test construction aspect back to the students can be really rewarding and also very fun for the classroom.
Excellent. Yeah, no, that's really, really good advice. Okay, let's move on. And I want to ask you a little bit about exam types. Mm-hmm. So do you think formative testing, that is testing that takes place throughout a course, is more effective than summative testing, as in the testing which takes place at the end of a course?
I'm going to answer this question in a bit of a roundabout way, I'm afraid, Patrick, because much in testing and assessment comes down to the answer, it depends. And really what it depends on is the purpose of why you're testing. Mm-hmm. Obviously, if you want to know what students are doing well, where you need to push them, where they need help, then formative is the only way to do that, the way that it feeds back into the learning and teaching process. But if you need to assess the suitability for a particular context outside the classroom or measure against external standards, then summative testing is probably fairer to have that standardized point at which everybody's being assessed against. If we take a couple of analogies in the summative side, you know, think of something like a driving test. You wouldn't want your driving test result to be based on your performance in the first lesson when you get behind the wheel.
Definitely not.
You'd want to have the value of all your learning and all your experience, and when you're ready for that final moment of being tested, that's the appropriate test at that point. But no more would you go to the doctor with symptoms in April and be told, well, I'll give you some. I'll give you a cure in December. That's not appropriate when we want to have things diagnosed. We want to respond to them quickly. Then we have to have formative assessment built into the course or to the syllabus to allow the teacher to respond appropriately. I think one of the other things to introduce here is the idea of learning-oriented assessment, which is a relatively new concept and tries to bridge the gap or reduce the tension between formative and summative testing. Mm-hmm. I think it tries to make the point that many summative test tasks, those kind of exam-type questions, can be used with a formative assessment purpose and also as teaching and learning materials, taking a final test task and breaking it down, reworking the questions, allowing learners to become involved with analysing the questions, giving meaningful feedback on those rather than just a score or a percentage, gets learners seeing it as a cycle rather than this linear progression towards the scary moment at the end of the course.
Okay, yeah, that's really, really interesting. So let's move on again. So teachers are often concerned that their exam classes teach students to pass the exam, so they get a lot of exam technique practice, without at the same time developing their language skills and proficiency, not in relation to the exam. Is it possible to develop language skills and proficiency while also teaching exam technique?
Yeah, I mean, this is something that we call washback. It's the effect that a final test has on the teaching and learning that leads up to it. And you're absolutely right that there is a fear of kind of teaching towards the test, and teachers can feel that all they're doing is really practicing exam questions and teaching exam strategies. I think it's unfair in some ways to blame the test developer for this. It's, in my perspective, it's the teacher's job to understand the test and what it's testing, and to look for ways to develop the underlying skills or knowledge that's being measured by the test in creative ways. For example, you've got a reading test that you know is going to be a piece of text with multiple choice questions. Why not take away the options and make it a race in the classroom to circle where the correct answer can be found in the text? Or, as we said earlier, get learners to bring in their own text and make questions based on them, or get groups to work on a question each and explain to the rest how they got the answer in their first language if necessary, because what we're actually trying to do is get beyond the test item type and look at what's being actually tested. And so I think all of those skills that are being developed in a good language learning environment are the skills that a good test is trying to measure, just for the teacher to see the bridge between the two.
Okay. Now, last year, the EL Gazette reported that China was going to roll out national language tests in 2020. But bearing in mind the different language learning issues experienced by various nationalities, do you think more nations will follow suit and have their own individual national language tests? Or do you think there should be a continued international standard exam like IELTS?
Yeah, very good question and very relevant for changes that are happening in kind of the move towards international standards across education, across curriculum areas. National tests, international standards like PISA and TIMSS get a lot of headline attention and are very important for education ministries who set policies. I think it's important to remember that many countries already develop their own national tests. In the recent years, I've been involved in development and validation of national tests in Austria and Germany and Nepal for very contrasting contexts. The national focus tests do have the advantage of being able to consider cultural and educational backgrounds and expectations, and also, importantly for me, developing the local capacity for test development. So countries, teachers and test designers are not dependent on external sources, but actually develop their own self-sufficiency and capacity to work with testing and assessment. But on the other hand, I don't think that accommodating to or explicit testing of first language influences on second language use are a particularly healthy way for test practices to go. I think cross-cultural communication and interaction between plurilingual speakers is the norm in many contexts. Mm-hmm. And I think international standards are probably a good way to reflect this, if not international exams. The international standards that we have around common points of reference, ways to talk about levels of proficiency, are a good way to go, despite their limitations or their potential for misuse in some contexts.
Okay, so possibly there's room for both, essentially. Finally, my last question. From your experience, what's the most important advice you would give to a teacher about to start a new exam class? And it could be any exam class.
I think the most important piece of advice I would give is know the exam. Know your exam really well. At the very least, take it as if you're a test taker and think about the kind of the cognitive processes, the way you would address the questions as a test taker. try to look under the bonnet of the test and get a good understanding of what each task or each set of items is really trying to measure, and ask your colleagues for their opinions on it and their experiences of teaching that exam and to that exam. Look for ways in which you can break the tasks in the test down into smaller chunks, and look for teaching activities which focus on the smaller parts rather than just practicing the whole in one lump. There's the big danger that teaching an exam class becomes one long test practice exercise with very little actual teaching going on. So put yourself in your student's shoes. What would you want to know about each part of the exam if you were going to take it, and how does your lesson help them develop those skills? And if you can answer that question to yourself successfully after each lesson you teach, then I think you're doing pretty well as a teacher of exam classes.
Wow, that's absolutely brilliant. That's fantastic advice. Well, it's been really, really great to speak to you and to learn a lot more about your experience. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Patrick. Thank you very much.
Absolutely. And look forward to hearing a lot more about NAHL in the coming months.
Absolutely. You certainly will.
Cheers. Take care.
Thank you, Patrick.
Well, some interesting stuff there from Tom, a man very much in the know when it comes to testing and assessment. For more information about NAHL, take a look at the show notes for this episode on the One Stop site. Okay, next up, it's Teacher's Dilemma. Each month we describe a common classroom issue and ask listeners to send in solutions. So Becca, what's this month's problem?
Okay, there's this student and there's this problem. Recently, this person has made a couple of risque comments in class. The comments sit on that very fine and subjective line between humour and causing offence. Class responses to the comments range from eye-rolling to sniggering to seriously furrowed eyebrows. Now, of course, it's not your job to tell students what or how to think, but this is your classroom and you feel responsible for what happens there. It's time to act, but what do you do?
Alex, any ideas? You must have come across this many times.
Yes, I'm sure we all have many times. I think you mentioned risque, so we recognise that there is a line that if someone crossed, perhaps we'd be dealing with it in a different manner. I think the first thing is to be clear what they actually said. Mm-hmm. You mentioned, you know, different reactions to it. Are we actually sure that the person said what they meant to say? So I'd always see my job first and foremost as enabling a student to express themselves, you know, accurately and fluently. And so I would take the time to perhaps get them to repeat their comment and just be sure that they wanted to say what they said. As for if that comment did cross a particular line, I personally wouldn't, unless it was of an extreme nature, not want to humiliate that person in front of their classmates. I would probably be going along the line of dealing with it outside class afterwards on a personal basis. Mm-hmm. Again, we can only imagine what the comments are, so I think we'd all recognise it's contextual.
Do you think there's any place for expanding on it, using it as a discussion point for the class, depending on what it is and how, you know, obviously offensive it is, but is there any cause for that kind of taboos and issues type topic?
Yes, it depends on the context of the class. I think if it was relevant to a discussion, if you're having a debate where people are going to be making comments that might seem offensive or unpalatable to someone else, well, if that is the context of the class or the function of the class, then you almost have to allow it within it. But I wouldn't follow it up if it was a bit of a throwaway comment that was out of context.
Yeah, it's interesting, this role of the teacher and the line that we're talking about. Mm. And like I said, it's subjective. So who decides what that line is? It's a cultural thing, perhaps, a gender thing. But yeah, it is your classroom. So
yeah, I think preparation for the class is key as well. Being aware of who your students are, what potential problems there might be. If it's a multinational class, and then maybe you've got students who might be from different nations, which there could be some historical context. Being aware of that before class and preparing so you know the topic and you're aware that things may come up, and then how to deal with them if they do come up.
Yeah, be prepared.
Great. Okay, so listeners, over to you. How do you deal with students making offensive comments? Send your solutions to onestoppodcast@springernature.com. All right, last up, as always, it's Q&A time on the One Stop Podcast, part of the show in which we try to answer your questions. First up this month is something we touched on before, but it's worth bringing up again, I think. Is there still a place for deductive grammar presentations in the modern language classroom? Alex, what do you think?
No.
No. Ooh. Care to expand on that a bit more?
Well, I mean, I'm sure there's always going to be an exception to that. But bottom line is, I have a big problem with the idea of language being taught as passive information. And I don't think that does the student any service if we're trying to focus on speaking and listening skills. I think the one point I'd like to make, because I think that's probably a fairly obvious debate, is the impact it has on the teaching. Because I think if teachers see that their role is to be able to have a command of teaching grammar points, I think that feeds into, not very well, in terms of students reaching their objectives on a more functional basis. Do you follow me?
Yes.
Yeah. And really, if they're not involved, then perhaps it's more difficult for them to remember the grammar anyway. So it's probably not the best way for them to learn.
Mm.
Okay. Next question. Is it important for students to lose their accent? What do you guys think?
Personally speaking, no. I don't think so. I think intelligibility is the goal. Mm-hmm. And I think actually keeping your accent is a good thing and a thing that should be encouraged.
So really, if it's impeding your communication, that's a problem, isn't it? Mm-hmm. But that's a general problem. It's not necessarily about the accent. It's about your general prong.
Without mm-hmm. doubt. Although I think just to throw a spanner in the works, I'm not saying that I completely agree with what you said, but I do have a colleague who used to make a good point about every time we try to speak French. We almost get our mouths into a certain position before we say it. It just seems mm-hmm. almost natural to put on some kind of French accent.
To kind of play the role.
And I am increasingly curious in the classrooms here in London whether, to kind of get students to have fun with putting on their idea of a British or American, whatever accent they feel comfortable with. Something that, on a practical level, I'm almost encouraging teachers to start exploring. But it'd be interesting to know what you guys and your listeners think about that.
Because we think like French has a sound and a rhythm and even without saying the words, it's a like that. But what is the British one? What's ours?
Right.
What do other people think?
I think the key word is rhythm, actually, because in order to to have we have a recognisable French rhythm. In order to kind of copy that, we do an accent. The same with, Italian. I used to live in Italy, and there is that Japanese, right. Another one. So, what is the British rhythm, and can an accent aid us in mimicking that to a degree?
Yeah, interesting. Okay, so listeners, send in your thoughts. And finally, if you could only teach one level for the rest of your teaching career, what level would you choose, and why? Should we go around? Does anybody have any ideas?
Yeah, Patrick? I mean, I could say I'd probably go with advanced. I just think that I'm always a big fan of idiomatic language, and I love having debates in class as well. I like to get students' opinions, and I think with advanced learners, you get more. I personally speaking, have very interesting issues. Not so much
you
across not personally the students do, but they're different. At lower levels you have issues which go kind of across the board, whereas at higher levels you might get students who have individual issues, which I kind of like. So for me, advanced.
Okay, advanced. Alex?
I was going to say I don't trust any teacher who says that they just like to teach advanced students, because beginners.
Oh, yeah, that's what I was going to say. Yeah, why for you?
Because it's just so rewarding.
Absolutely.
For them and for yourself. I mean, I must admit, forever, you're going to kill yourself eventually if you have to just teach beginners.
Yeah.
But it's a wonderful experience.
But they seem to make such quick progress, don't they? And it is rewarding. I agree.
Pre-int. Okay. Because they know enough to have a bit of a discussion and they're just on that lovely kind of precipice of jumping off. And there's a lot of joy in learning the language. And of course there is at all levels, but somehow, I don't know, maybe I've just had good fun pre-in classes.
Yeah, okay, very interesting. And even spread then.
And we seem to be ignoring the poor upper ends, but what can you do?
Wow. Okay, well that's it for this month. If you have any questions, suggestions or feedback, please email us at onestoppodcast@springernature.com or leave a comment on the One Stop page. Thank you, as always, to our regular panellists.
Cheers, Sam.
Thank you.
A big thanks to our guest teacher this month, Alex Tustain.
Thanks, Sam.
Thank you for listening. And until next month, this is the One Stop English podcast.